This afternoon, we are beginning the final chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. The first section of the final chapter, though, is a very practical section because it's a section about our relationships with sinners. And if you have a relationship with any person, then you have a relationship with somebody who sins. And so Jesus gives us some very practical instructions about navigating those relationships as we try to be dedicated to the kingdom of God and his righteousness in our lives. The section comes in three parts. First is the teaching, and then there are two illustrations, and the two illustrations help to qualify the teaching. And so as we go through that, I hope that becomes clear. But let's begin by just looking at this very well-known verse in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1, where Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged." I would venture to guess that this verse is among the most well-known, if not the most well-known verse in the sermon. It seems that if people know no other scripture, they know that one, because I think they tend to think that it gives them license that it actually doesn't give. But the reason why this verse is a challenging verse to understand is, first of all, primarily because of the meaning of the word judge. Whenever you think about the meaning of a word, really what you're thinking about is the lexical range, the range of definitions, the range of usage in which you can use it. And so, generally speaking, the word judge means to determine or to distinguish. But there's a large range of meanings that fall under that umbrella. And it's true both in Greek and in English that the word judge can refer to a range of different things. And at one end of that range would be a synonym like discernment. You know, when you make a judgment about something, you are discerning something. You might judge the distance between yourself and the next car on the interstate, and that's an important judgment to make. That's an important discernment. You might judge the color of a paint, and you might argue with your spouse whether it's more blue or more green. But you are making a discernment. You're making a judgment based on what you can see. And so on one end of that range is making a determination, making a judgment, trying to, as accurately as you can, based on what you know, based on what you're able to observe, make some kind of distinguishment. But on the other end of that lexical range is a synonym like condemnation. When you judge somebody, you are condemning them. And usually when we talk about judgment in that sense, we're talking about it in a legal context. So when a court passes judgment on a criminal, it's a condemnation. The court makes a determination about what the lawbreaker deserves for his crime, and then the judge sits in a position of authority to hand down the judgment to the one who is guilty. So on the one end, we have discernment, and on the other end, we have condemnation. And Jesus is prohibiting one of those. He's telling us that we are not to sit in a position of condemnation. That's not our place. It's the second end of that spectrum. And the reason why we know that's true is because Jesus himself used the word judge in different ways. In John chapter 7, in verse 24, he gives this instruction. He says, "Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment." And so there's a type of judgment that would be inappropriate, a judgment that's just, you know, looking at what's on the surface, not really being understanding about what you might not be able to see, being swift to condemn. And Jesus says, don't do that. But in James chapter 4 and verse 12, James really hits the same note that Matthew 7:1 does. And he says, there is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? And so James reminds us of really the principle that Jesus is talking about as well, that there is only one judge. There's only one who is qualified to sit in a position of authority and pronounce condemnation. It is the lawgiver himself. And that's God. God alone is the judge. We need to remember that he's the only one in the position to be such. And yet, we still have to make determinations about what's right and wrong. We have to be able to distinguish between good and bad, between what's holy and righteous and what's wicked and what's evil. We've got to make those distinguishments both in our own lives and sometimes even in the lives of others. We need to be able to identify sin based on what God has said. And sometimes other people might feel judged by the judgments that we make. We talked this morning about how Noah condemned the world. Well, the way that Noah condemned the world was that he was willing to do what God told him to do. He was willing to listen to God. And everybody around him made their own choice. And so by his obedience, there was an implicit judgment, an implicit condemnation. And there are going to be times when we come to understand what the will of God is and how to apply it to our lives. And it might mean that we have to stop doing some things that we used to be doing. And it might mean that we start doing some things that we weren't doing before. And if people around us are not making those same changes in their lives, they might feel judged by the actions that we take. And so there's a balance here. We can discern between good and evil, and we ought to, but we can't condemn anyone for anything. That's not our place, and we don't have the authority. And the difference between the two extremes of this range is mainly about attitude. It's mainly about attitude. You see that in Romans chapter 14. In Romans 14, Paul is talking about matters of judgment, things that people might disagree about because they come from different backgrounds or different perspectives. There might be things that are not extremely clear, and so people arrive at different conclusions. And this is the instruction that he gives in Romans 14:10. Why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or you, why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. And so you see the way that he talks about passing judgment on your brother in parallel with despising your brother. If we ever sit in a position of judgment where we look down on our brothers, then really what we're doing is putting ourselves in the place of God. The only one who can look down on anybody is the one who is highly exalted, and none of us are. And so there's a humility that comes with the judgments that we make for ourselves and the way that we talk about differences with our brethren. I think the best representation of righteous judgment is actually Jesus himself and the way that he explains it in John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, Jesus talks about his own judgments. And he says in verse 30, I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. If I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who bears witness about me. And I know that the testimony that he bears about me is true. So notice that Jesus is saying that even he is careful, even he shows some restraint, even he shows submission to the will of the Father. He wouldn't dare to make any judgments that God hasn't made. But when God has made a judgment, when God has made a declaration, then he can speak boldly, knowing that that is the will of God because God has borne witness to it. And so the judgments that Jesus condemns are the ones where we put ourselves in the place of God. The ones where we put ourselves in the position that only the judge should occupy. A place where we look down on others and think in some way that we have the right to condemn them. Especially because of our own preferences or our own opinions or things like that. And so based on all of that, here is the teaching in verse 2. Verse 1 says, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." I think there's probably a couple of different ways in which this teaching is true. One is that the way that we judge other people tends to be the way that other people will judge us. When we act like we have some dedication to righteousness, and we should, then other people are going to hold us accountable to who we claim to be. But if we are unmerciful and we're impatient and we're quick to condemn, how will other people treat us? They'll tend to be unmerciful, impatient, quick to condemn. As soon as they see a flaw in you, they're going to be quick to point the finger right back. And so Jesus is exercising some caution there. But even more importantly, I think what Jesus is talking about is the way that God will actually judge us. And that's a sobering thought. Whenever you slip into a more judgmental frame of mind, whenever you begin to be less merciful in your judgments of others, whenever you're quick to condemn them and be impatient, it ought to give you pause. It ought to make you take a step back and say, is this really the way that I want God to judge me? Do I want God to be looking for every reason to doubt his approval of me? Do I want God to be as patient with me as I am with other people? Do I want God to see my efforts and understand my struggles and be merciful in his judgments? Or do I want God looking for every reason to condemn me? And the way that we answer those questions will have a lot of bearing on the way that we interact with other people. Jesus wants us to look at other people the way God does. But he also wants us to remember that we're not God. And that we're only able to see from our own limited perspective. So that's the teaching. And from there, Jesus introduces a little bit of comedy. This is without a doubt the funniest section of the sermon. If you just allow your mind's eye to create a mental image of what Jesus talks about, you'll see his very effective use of comedy here. In verse 3, Jesus goes on to explain it like this. "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." You know, if you could just imagine what this would look like if it was a comedy sketch or if it was in a movie, I imagine that you'd have one scene where some guy would be rubbing his eye and he would be thinking like, "Oh man, I've got something stuck in my eye. Is there anybody that can help me with this?" And you hear a voice say, I can help. And then, you know, the scene shifts and there's a guy with like a 2x4 hanging out of his eyeball, you know, and then it would shift back to the first guy and he would just kind of shake his head and be like, "No thanks," right? It's hilarious. It's absurd. It's supposed to be funny. And it's absurd to think that somebody could be so blind to their own enormous faults while at the same time being so attuned to the faults of others. That's absurd. Or is that actually accurate for the way we tend to be? We see the comedy in the physical scene. We ought to see just the sad absurdity in a spiritual sense. We tend to fixate on other people's flaws while ignoring our own. And notice again the way Jesus says that in verse 3. He says, "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" Those are two different words in English and two different words in Greek. And isn't that the way that it tends to work? There's often a difference between what we see and what we notice. We tend to see the specks in our brother's eyes while we don't notice the log in our own. And maybe it's because we know that it's there. You know, it's not like we're just mentally or physically handicapped, where we're just not able to see it, but we're choosing not to notice it. It's a choice that we're making. Maybe from our perspective, the log in our eye seems like a speck, and the speck in our brother's eye seems like a log. And we think, well, I know I've got a speck in my eye, but I'm going to try to help him with his log first. And Jesus says, we're not really seeing the truth of the matter if that's our attitude. But we tend to think that we're the ones with small problems, and other people are the ones with the big problems. But the reality is, no matter what the size of the problem is, the problem needs to be solved. Whether you've got a speck or a log in your eye, it needs to come out. And Jesus is giving us some good instruction about how to make that happen. But the point is that unless you deal with your log, you're never going to be able to help your brother with his speck. Unless you judge your own sins more seriously than the sins of others, then you'll never be able to help other people with their sins. People are quick to notice hypocrisy. Hypocrisy gets in the way. And again, if we could go back to the comedy sketch, imagine that the guy with the speck lets the guy with the log try to help him. And, you know, he's like leaning over trying to get the speck out. And meanwhile, he's like clocking the guy across the face with the log. Now the guy's got bigger problems. The hypocrisy gets in the way. And you know, if you've ever had a relationship with somebody who is hypocritical, how true that is. If it was a parent, if it was a preacher, if it was some role model that you had and you discovered the hypocrisy, it totally undermines anything good that he ever had to say to you. But when we get the hypocrisy out of the way, then we're actually in a position to help each other. Then we're also able to see clearly enough to help. And so the picture here is that we need to be helping each other get the specks out of our eyes. There is a judgment involved in that. We've got to be able to recognize the specks and the logs, both in ourselves and in each other. But there's a way to go about this. And even if you've got just a speck in your eye, it's still a pretty serious problem. If you've ever had like a little piece of sawdust in your eye or a little piece of a plant, I mean, it can be a tiny, tiny piece and it can ruin your day. It makes your vision cloudy, you know, you got tears coming down your face. It's painful, it's uncomfortable. The speck is not to be ignored. But sometimes we need each other's help to get those specks out. And how do you want somebody to get a speck out of your eye? Imagine that you were that guy and you had a speck in your eye and somebody said, "I'll help you with that." How do you want them to go about that? You know, would you like for them to come at you with the kitchen tongs and say, "Let me see if I can grab it"? I mean, you probably wouldn't even like for them to come with a pair of tweezers. You know, it's like, stay away. But if they came with something soft and delicate, you know, the corner of a napkin, and gently, gently helped to get it out, that would be something you'd be very grateful for. And so, to be able to do that for each other, we have to be willing to see the logs and the specks in our own eyes. We've got to get the hypocrisy out of the way to help each other with the sin that besets us. Well, with that being said, the comedy show continues in verse 6. Jesus goes on to say, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." I can imagine that the people who heard the Sermon on the Mount for the first time looked at each other and said, "Did the guy who just told us not to judge people turn around and call other people dogs and pigs?" You know, like, that's just funny. It's just hilarious that he would do that. What's he trying to show us, though? Well, Jesus has just finished describing a situation among brothers. He's just described a situation where people are helping each other with their problems. But now, he describes a situation where someone is trying to share the gospel with somebody who doesn't want it. And Jesus is telling us, when that happens, you have to be able to recognize that that's happening. You have to be able to recognize that you're trying to give something to somebody that they're not able to digest, they're not willing to accept. And the more that you try to shove it down their throats, the less effective you're going to be. You know, when he talks about the dogs in verse 6, he talks about giving to the dogs there. Jesus is talking about the time-honored tradition of slipping your table scraps to man's best friends. We weren't the ones that invented that. As far back as the first century, people had dogs running around, and when they finished eating, they would throw the scraps to the dogs. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 27, remember, there was a Canaanite woman who talked to Jesus, and she referenced that. She said, "Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." If you've got a dog at home, you know just how much dogs love table scraps. But why do dogs like table scraps? Well, it's because they're edible. It's because they taste good. It's because the table scraps are a treat for their stomachs. They're hungry. They salivate for that. Dogs like table scraps because they can eat them. What if you took a handful of pearls and you tossed them to a pig? She wouldn't care very much about that. Why? Because she's a pig and she can't eat pearls. You know, no matter how beautiful the pearls are, I mean, they could be the greatest pearls in the history of pearls. They could be the finest pearls in the whole world. But if you threw them before a pig, she wouldn't want to have anything to do with them. You might pick them up and polish them and try to convince the pig that these are actually very valuable. You might put them on a string and hang it around the pig's neck and say, "Look how beautiful you look wearing them." The pig's not going to have it for very long. In fact, the pig's going to get aggravated that you keep trying to give her pearls that she doesn't care about, and she might have this thought. She might say, "I can't eat those, but I can eat you." And so the picture here is of annoying a dog or annoying a pig to the point of violence, to where they get so frustrated with your efforts that they trample underfoot what you're giving them and they turn to attack you. Do you see the point here? Jesus is telling us that there are some people who want the specks out of their eyes, and there are other people who just don't see the value. And you can't help those. You can't make somebody appreciate the value of the gospel. And when you love the dog or you love the pig, that's a really hard pill to swallow. But Jesus is telling us that that's the reality. We can't change people's hearts. In Matthew chapter 13, Jesus tells another parable about a pearl. He says in verse 45 and verse 46, "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it." In both cases, the pearl is the gospel. The pearl of great price is the most valuable message in the world, but there will be some people who are searching for it. There will be some people who are hungry for it. There will be some people who are willing to sell all that they have in order to take it, and then there will be other people who won't take it if you give it to them. There will be people like Paul describes in Philippians 3:19. He says, their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. And they glory in their shame with minds set on earthly things. And so it's a very sad situation that Jesus describes. But what he's doing is giving us a dose of reality. And there's a certain liberation in this. Because we might make our very best attempts to show somebody the pearl of great price, and they might refuse to see the value of it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we failed to do the job that we were supposed to do. It might just mean that they are unwilling to recognize it for what it is. Now, that's not to say that people can't change. People can certainly change. Most sheep are former dogs and pigs. I would imagine that all of us could think of a time in our lives where we didn't appreciate the value of the gospel, where maybe even we bristled up at people who tried to share it with us and we resisted it. Dogs and pigs can change. But as long as someone is acting like a dog or a pig, the best thing that you can do is leave them be. They won't appreciate the treasure you're trying to share. And if you don't leave them alone, eventually they might turn and lash back at you. And so Jesus told his 12 disciples when he sent them out two by two in Matthew chapter 10, verses 12 through 14, as you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Jesus also told them that there would be some people who didn't want the gospel, and we can't give people what they're not willing to take. Now, what's the common thread in all of these verses? I think the common thread here is that Jesus is telling us that whatever we do, however we interact with people, no matter what sin they're caught up in, no matter whether it's a brother with a speck or a log, or whether it's somebody we're trying to teach the gospel to, that however we interact with people, that we do all that we can to try to help them. If there's some judgment, some determination that we make where we identify some problem in their life that we're trying to help them with, we do it in a spirit of trying to help them, not to hurt them. Not to tear them down so that we can look down on them as being superior, but to come alongside them and to say, this is the message that will help you, just as it helps me. If we see something is wrong in somebody's life, we would be their friend to help them get it right. Jesus isn't telling us to ignore signs of a problem. He's not telling us to give somebody the false impression that we approve of something sinful that they're practicing in their life. But when we do that, we have to be so gentle. It's so delicate. You can so easily hurt someone. And if we are going to bring something to somebody's attention, we need to be sure that we're not being hypocritical by ignoring the problems in ourselves. None of us are perfect, but because we're brothers, we ought to be able to help each other. I'll finish with Ephesians chapter 4. I so appreciate the instructions that Paul gives to brethren here, and I think that it's closely connected to with what Jesus teaches in Matthew 7. In Ephesians 4 and verse 11, Paul writes, he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Paul says, Jesus gave us gifts in order to make us like him. How do we actually accomplish that? Well, in verse 15, he says, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. The opposite of judging others is speaking the truth in love. It's not writing people off as being a lost cause too quickly. It's not hyper-fixating on their flaws while ignoring our own. But in a spirit of love, it's patiently showing them, this is what God has said. This is how we know what's good and what's bad. This is how we know what's right and what's wrong. Instead of sitting up on our high horse and condemning people for their faults and ignoring our own, we ought to be lovingly bringing each other back to the truth of God's word. We ought to be trying to help each other apply it because we both appreciate its beauty and its value and what it's doing in our lives. And so we have to speak the truth, but we have to speak it in love. And when we do that, we make each other more like Jesus. And isn't that what all of this is about? The purpose of the Sermon on the Mount is to make us like the preacher, to make us like him. And so, when you learn to let his words live in you, you become like him. When you begin to see others the way he sees you, then others will begin to see you the way you see him. And I'll let you chew on that one for a minute. But the point of all of this is that we help each other grow up into the image of Jesus. The more that we realize, the more that our judgments are brought into submission to the judgments that God has made, the more we become like Jesus. The more we help each other be the people that he wants us to be. The more that we can help each other effectively instead of tearing each other down and hurting each other along the way. And so, there might be somebody here this afternoon who realizes that you need to begin this journey in becoming more like Jesus. Maybe you've been convicted by some kind of judgment that you've been able to make about yourself, some discernment that you've been given about a change that you need to make. If you're not a Christian, I hope that you'll act on that judgment. And if there's some sin in your life that you need help with, I hope that you'll let somebody know so that they can help you, so that we can help each other get the specks out of our eyes gently and in a spirit of love. If there's somebody here that would like to ask for help in your relationship with God, we would invite you to let us know. You can come to the front while we stand together and sing.